As you enter the new portraiture exhibit at the Kemper Museum, the first thing you see right in front of you is a painting of a slender African-American woman in a crisp navy blue tank dress. She wears a red fascinator hat, and she's holding a giant white teacup in gloved hands. This painting is a big deal. It's by Amy Sherald, the artist commissioned by the National Portrait Gallery to paint former First Lady Michelle Obama. And it's the painting that got her career back on track after congestive heart failure forced her into a 3-year hiatus from making art. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're starting today's show with Amy Sherald. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing great, thank you.
I want to start by saying congratulations on the Michelle Obama portrait. I know you can't say much about it, but that's obviously huge, so congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's really exciting.
Talk to me about the painting I just described. It's called Miss Everything, and then in parentheses, Unsuppressed Deliverance.
Well, it's a portrait that I did in 2014 of a friend of mine, and I had found the dress first, and I had been waiting to find the model, the perfect model for this dress. I had found it in the vintage shop, and it was really small. And I ran into my friend Crystal, and it instantly came to me that she would be perfect for the dress. And so I proceeded to photograph her. And at that time, I was also thinking a lot about Alice in Wonderland. I don't know how it made its way back into my brain, but that's why the teacup, it's so large. It's like a commentary on being able to bend space with imagination.
Huh. That was inspired kind of by the costume? I mean, I say costume because you found this outfit and wanted to find someone to put in it.
Mm-hmm. It was a little bit of everything. I think my work has always been a derivative, because my body of work in general is inspired by the movie Big Fish. I don't know whether you've seen it or not, but there's lots of characters in these different movies. And so I was really inspired to create these archetypes that are extricated from the dominant historical narrative. And so each one of them live in a different world, in a liminal space. And some of their props are ways that I can kind of show that to the viewer.
Can you tell me more about Big Fish and what you saw in it that captivated you?
Well, at the time, I was doing some visual research, and I had gone to the library here in Baltimore, Maryland, to look for stories, any kind of stories that that were American stories about Black people that I had never heard about before. So when I saw that movie, the father in the movie had told his son all these different stories about his life, that he had a friend who was a giant, and he went swimming, and his wife's engagement ring came off, and he had to wrestle a 6-foot catfish, and all these different kinds of stories. And I realized that for me, I didn't have those kind of stories connected to my narrative as a Black American woman. And so it was my inspiration to kind of paint the things that I wanted to see in the world.
You know, there's a formative story I've read about you telling from your childhood and just different articles about you. It's about a visit to a museum where you saw a painting by the artist Beau Bartlett. And that seems kind of related to what you're talking about as well. Can you tell that story?
Mm-hmm. Well, we had, it was my first time going to a museum. So my parents never really pushed me into the arts. I was supposed to be a doctor and take over my father's dental practice.
I can relate to that.
But for this field trip, we went to the Columbus Museum. And there was a painter by the name of Beau Bartlett. He's known as an American realist. He had a solo exhibition up. And so growing up, I was born in the early 70s. So my interaction with art was through the pages of encyclopedias. So I, you know, was looking at these European paintings, these figurative European paintings of, you know, Michelangelo or Velázquez or whoever was in the encyclopedia. And I never really saw any images that looked like me in a painting. And so when I walked into the museum and I, you know, as a class, we were walking around, I walked up to this painting. The name of it is Object Permanence. And there was a figure in the painting that looked something like my father. And it just really struck me in that moment that I had never seen anything like that before. And I was just mesmerized by it. But because of that, I, you know, in that moment, I knew what I wanted to do with my life. And I knew that I could do it because of what I saw in front of me.
Something you're known for is your use of gray paint to depict the skin tone of your subjects who are African American. I had never seen your portraits up close before yesterday. I had seen images on a screen. And when I visited the Kemper, the effect is really striking in a way that a reproduction of your work just can't capture. Can you talk about,
Well,
like,
most.
yeah, what you're doing there?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things that happen after a painting is born. There's a lot of words that come to it. But in the beginning of anything, for me, it's always an aesthetic decision. And so I hadn't quite, in the beginning, when I started this body of work, when I figured out that this is what I wanted to do, come to the conclusion that I was going to paint the skin in gray. I use Mars Black and Naples Yellow. But in starting the painting, the very first one, I start with gray as an undercolor so that I can get the face in the way that I want it to before I start with glazing and color. And it just struck me that it looked really beautiful that way. And so that's how it began. But I think as an artist, you're working intuitively, so you understand that there's something happening there, and you just kind of trust your gut and leave it. And so, looking back at it, I realized that, it's kind of pointing to the construction of race. And in a way, I think I was thinking about, because my work prior to that was ambiguous. So you would look at it, you wouldn't know whether it's painted by a man or a woman or a black man or a black woman or a Mexican. You would not know. But I think I was a little bit afraid of the marginalizing that would possibly happen because I was painting a black figure, because I still, blackness still changes spaces. And so I didn't want the narrative to be trapped in that, in an identity. Or interpret it in that way. And so I think also I was trying to move the figure into a place that it could live more freely.
They look to me like charcoal drawings wearing clothes against bright backgrounds. And it's interesting because race is clear, but it's also colorless.
Well, we look at each other through our phenotypes as well.
Can you explain what you mean
So
by
you
that?
could be very fair and have blonde hair, but have African American features. So I mean, that's also something that, you can't escape that, as you can't escape that.
It does seem like the background colors on your canvases are really important. They convey a mood, in a way that I guess, I don't know, it seems like just one of a really important part of these paintings. And I think of that especially with the other painting you have in the Kemper right now called I Try On Dreams Until I Find the One That Fits Me. They All Fit Me. And the background is this light, bright lavender.
I love color. I mean, the backgrounds are almost reference the photographs that I ended up looking at growing up, these old black and white photographs with a kind of neutral background. And when I think about the work now, I also connect it to these black and white photographs that I came across while doing visual research in the process of, producing the work. But it's the backgrounds are determined by the sitter and by what the sitter is wearing. So it's the first decision that I make when I'm, beginning a painting.
Your work, as I mentioned, is included in this portraiture exhibit, and it's a picture of what portraiture, the best portraiture, really looks like today in 2017. And I'm curious about what portraiture means to you. What is important about it, and what is its role, yeah, today, right now in our society?
For me, it's about self-narration, being able to narrate my own story. It's about creating mirrors. And I think also the way that I want my work to live in museums is that it will have the power to change people's expectations of what they see when they go to a museum. I think that the connection to our photographic history as Black Americans, I really connect the presence of portraiture to that, because in those photographs were the first times that I was able to see people that look like me. And once the camera was invented, that was when we were able to start to create our own narratives that were counter narratives to a lot of the racial propaganda that was happening at the time. And so I really see the painting functioning in that same way, which is offering the viewer, no matter race or gender, a place to rest their eyes, but in particular for people of color, a place to have a reflection of themselves within an institution that tells you what's valid and what to cherish, like what's important.
You know, you mentioned finding this dress that you wanted to put a model in and create a painting from. Can you tell me what was it about that garment that said this is important, this belongs in that kind of space, this kind of space you just described?
I just love polka dots. I mean, everything about that dress said that it spoke to me. The material that it was made out of, the fact that polka dots were only on one side of the dress. The actual dress itself was like a creamy yellow color, like a very pale lemon color with orange polka dots. And so I changed it to the navy blue because as I began to paint it, I realized that for some reason it wasn't working. But I'm not really sure. Like, that's one of those things that I just know in my gut that I really don't have words for. It's just, it belongs to me. When I see it, it belongs to me. Just like when I see my models, I know exactly, in a room full of people, I can pick out one person and I know that that's the person that I will be able to paint that will represent what I'm trying to say.
I mentioned earlier that heart failure and a transplant forced you to stop painting for a while, and there was also a cascade of family tragedy at the same time. Can you talk to me about that period in your life?
It was tough, but I also look back at it at my 2 months in the hospital. I was waiting for a heart at the same time that my brother was dying from lung cancer.
And you were, can I
And
just
so
jump in and
my
say that
mom.
you were waiting for a heart, even though your plan before you found out that you had heart failure was to run a marathon, wasn't it?
Yeah, I had been training. That was my passion. I'm an athlete as much as I'm an artist. And so it was really a struggle to lose that part of my identity because when I was diagnosed with heart failure, my doctor told me I couldn't work out anymore. My heart function was at 18%. And so I was asymptomatic and had no idea. So I just would have been one of those, athletes that just dropped dead in a race and everybody's like, we don't know what happened. So I'm lucky that I went to the doctor when I did and that I was diagnosed when I was.
And yeah, you were starting to talk about your brother's diagnosis as well.
So he was diagnosed with lung cancer and he was he had maybe 3 or 4 months to live, we weren't sure. But at the same time I began my I called my doctor and I'm like, I think something's wrong, and so they went in and we did the stress test on the treadmill and my heart function was down to 5%. So because I was in such great shape, it wasn't until I was, it was literally not almost not beating that out, that I started to be symptomatic, and then I had to call my brother and tell him that I wasn't going to be able to come back home again, and then we had to figure out a way to tell my mom without, freaking her out. So somehow I found a way to do it in the hospital, like tell her that it was going to happen. But by the time we got off the phone, she was laughing about it, and I'm not sure what I said, but I just
Good
knew that I
job.
had to make her confident that I was going to be okay. But I'm also the middle child, so I feel like I'm a lot more independent than my other siblings are. So I think she knows that no matter what, Amy's going to be okay.
Well, so that ended up being time away from not just running, but also painting. What was that like for you? This painting at the Kemper, I understand that it's a painting that really changed things for you, but after this time period. And I just wonder if this was not just a personal transition, but a career transition too.
Well, it was, I mean, when I think of that painting, I think about how I was feeling. And, you know, after you have a heart transplant, you have to take a lot of drugs. And one of them specifically it's called Prograf. It's neurotoxic. And so you're experiencing all these personality changes and you're not really sure what's happening. You're on prednisone at the same time. And so you just feel really crazy. So I was very irritable. And for some reason, I just wasn't happy. And I was complaining about the painting when I was making it. I was like, this is stupid. I don't want to paint anymore. What other career can I have besides being an artist? And, you know, my friends were like, we don't know who you are right now, but, you know, we're not going to let you walk away from this. And so I finally realized that because of the drugs that I have to take, an antidepressant to counter the effects of the drugs. And that was a struggle for me as well, because I had never really had any emotional issues at all. You know, I went from being a completely healthy person with heart failure to a completely healthy person in a different way, but then with these other symptoms that I felt like dampened my sensibilities artistically a little bit too. So I've had to learn how to work around that as well, because, you know, when every pill that you take says don't operate machinery, you know, it has some effect on your cognitive function and other things like that. So I think, after any kind of big surgery, you have to realize that there's an old self and then there's a new self. And so I had a little bit of trouble accepting this new self and this new brain. But after 3 years, I finally wrapped my head around it.
That was the new self, it sounds almost like the old self might have been judging the new self too, looking at that painting.
Yeah, you know, there was a lot of judging because I thought I was going to go back to training for triathlons. I was going to go to the Transplant Olympics. I purchased like an $1,800 road bike and started cycling. And then I realized that I didn't really want to do that anymore. Like, it had been 11 years since I was able to use my body in that way. And at 40 years old, I didn't have the same passion and drive that I wanted to. And I felt like I had used up all of my push through, like whatever it is that athletes have that pushes us through the hills or whatever it is. Like when you're at the brink of like wanting to give up, like something comes up in you and you keep pushing forward. I felt like I had expended all of that energy in the hospital getting through everything that I had to get through, and I just didn't have the get up and go anymore. So I just had to accept the fact that I'm just going to go to the gym like a regular person and work out and like not be
a superhero.
And then I also realized like it's a full-time job, and I didn't have time to do that and pursue my career at the same time.
You know, this painting that you not only almost gave up on the painting, but the painting almost made you give up on your art career. It's now in this exhibit of the best portraiture, and it's you mm-hmm. won a portraiture award for it, like a giant portraiture award. Mm-hmm. What is it like for you to see that painting in this exhibit that's at the Kemper right now?
It means a lot, mostly because it was the first time my mother was like, oh, you're kind of a big deal. she never really got it. You know, she was asking me, you know, like whether I needed to get another job or, you know, are you sure you don't want to go back to school for it to be a sonogram technician or something like that? You know, something that's more stable. And so for me, when I think about that painting, I think about the moment my mom walked to the National Portrait Gallery and she got my life and she got everything that I had been hustling for and understood why I was 37 years old and still waiting tables, and, you know, like the dream finally came together for her. And so that's what I think about when I think about that painting.
Amy Sherrill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amy's got two portraits at the Kemper right now. Check them out. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, a new documentary has two grown men looking back on a youthful journey they took to the Sahara in the 1970s. I'm Gina Kaufman. viewer remembers riding shotgun with a ferry boat pilot on a tiny plane across the Atlantic in 1971.
There was some turbulence, I remember. And you're flying in this little airplane, and all of a sudden you jump up or fall, go down rapidly. And there's beautiful clouds, beautiful blue sky, beautiful big clouds. And I'm just sort of enjoying the view, and everything is feeling fine, and then the engine stops.
This doesn't sound like the beginning of a promising adventure.
It just sort of gets quiet. And the plane doesn't go down, it just keeps coasting.
And I look over at him, and he kind of looks at me and smiles and hits a switch, and then he switches gasoline tanks to go from the empty one to the full one, and the engine started along with my heart.
That scare was nothing compared to what lay ahead. Steve was on his way to meet his friend Dick, who was in Europe at the time, and they didn't know it yet, but they were about to hitchhike across the Sahara Desert, putting their lives and sanity in peril. Now their journey is the subject of a documentary showing at the Kansas International Film Festival. I'm Gina Kaufman, joined by these two friends decades later and the filmmaker telling their story. Steve Ewart, good morning.
Good morning.
And Dick Russell, hello to you.
Hi, Gina. Good morning to you.
We'll hear from the filmmaker about the project of turning this all into a documentary in a minute, but I want to start by reminiscing a little with the two of you. Dick, this trip, if I understand it right, was your bright idea. You were a writer for Sports Illustrated, doing pretty well as a sports journalist, but then something snapped. What happened?
You know, it was the late 1960s, the beginning of the 70s, and the world had changed and I had changed. I'd woken up that there was a lot more going on than sports. There was a Vietnam War, civil rights, hippies, all these things. And I felt the need to write about and explore something that I never had before. So I just took off. I quit my job at Sports Illustrated, much to the chagrin of my parents, and took off with a backpack and a portable typewriter and decided to roam around the world. And Steve and I had known each other at KU. We'd been in a rock band together. And we were both from Kansas City, had going all the way back to our middle school years. And so I asked him, because he was a terrific photographer, would he join me on the trip? And that's how it began.
But tell me more about your search for kind of, I don't know, to be part of this bigger thing that was going on. Because it sounds like you made a certain amount of effort to be part of a social movement of some kind, to use your writing that way, and kind of learned something about where those movements were in the process.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, in the beginning of the trip, I started before Steve, and I was exploring. I lived on John Lennon's island off the coast of Ireland. I was looking at Belfast, what was going on there. And then later, I wanted to explore the hip movement called the Kabouters in Amsterdam, and went to Paris with Steve at that point to find Jean-Paul Sartre and also look into what was going on with the Paris underground. Later in Algiers.
Did you find Jean-Paul Sartre?
No. It never happened. We found a lot of other things, but not Jean-Paul Sartre. But then
That's very existentialist in and of itself.
It is. Timothy Leary, the LSD guru, and Eldridge Cleaver of the Black Panthers were in exile in Algiers. So that's how we ended up going there. And in all these places, I kind of found that, I don't know, it didn't grab me in the same way. I mean, Leary was saying the same things he had in the mid-1960s, and the Panthers didn't want to see us. And, you know, so finally we kind of reached a point where do we go from here?
And, did it feel like it was all over, kind of?
Yeah, it kind of did. And we didn't know what to do except maybe there was a great adventure that could be had, maybe put something together for National Geographic magazine and head off across the Sahara and hitchhike it and see where it took us.
Well, Steve, tell me what your life was like at this point when Dick pitches this whole idea.
Well, I was an engineering student and because I was good at math and science. But I needed a medium of expression, and I didn't have one until I was a senior in college. And I went to KU, and you couldn't take a photo class unless you were a fine art major or a journalism major. So I had to talk my way into it. And they said, go talk to the guy in charge. And I did. And I said, I want to take a photo class, and I'm looking for my own medium of expression. And the guy said, no one has ever said that before, so sure. So I took two photo classes and discovered that was my passion. And then But before long, Dick and I went to Canada, did a story on draft dodgers, and then Dick had this idea, let's go do magazine articles in Europe and Africa. And I said, sure, Dick, I'll go with you. And, you know, Dick was the brains behind all this stuff, but I got to use my medium of expression. I got to take pictures in all these phenomenal places and, you know, learned a lot about what I love.
And those pictures are what you see on the screen for a lot of this documentary, which is really cool. I mean, I'm curious about how the mood of the early 70s and I guess the late 60s leading up to that affected you. Were you also itching to be part of this spirit of change and revolution that seemed to be agitating the status quo?
No. I was just a guy who was finishing engineering school and discovered my talent, and Dick offered me an opportunity to have an adventure and to make pictures. And you know, I had a high lottery number, so I didn't have to go to Vietnam. So I got out of that, and I was opposed to it. I was doing, you know, in protest at KU, but it was nothing like Dick's involvement or how Dick thought about things. I just wanted to make pictures.
As we've heard, your trip started with a terrifying plane ride.
Yeah, I was engaged, and my fiance knew about this company in Wichita where the planes were ferried across the Atlantic. And in some cases, the guy that I got a ride with was going to Nairobi, Kenya. So it's a two-engine twin Cessna. It seats eight. They take all the seats out and fill it with gasoline tanks. So it's basically once you take off, you cannot land because the landing gear will break and you will explode. So once we took off across the Atlantic, then of course, if you go into the water, it doesn't matter anyway. But there was no GPS. There was only a compass on this plane. So in those days, there were two boats across the Atlantic, a third and two thirds across, to all the way to Europe. And they put out a 200-mile beacon. And if you got within the beacon, then you knew where you were. And the pilot I was with got within the beacon. And so both beacons, and then we landed in Shannon, Ireland. And, you know, the guy was telling me stories about crashing these planes, you know, how people had crashed these planes while we're flying across.
Oh, my God.
But I was 23, and I thought I was bulletproof. So I just figured it would be okay.
Dick, I mean, talk to me about what happens when your friend arrives and what ultimately causes this detour where you start hitchhiking across the Sahara. You've kind of set that up for us, but there's a reason that you're hitchhiking in particular.
Yeah, we'd actually had two cars and lost them both. We had a little Volkswagen in Amsterdam, which the police confiscated from us because they didn't like us photographing these hippies, the kabouters, in front of their police station and maybe making them look bad.
Wait, can you tell me about the kabouters? Because you've brought them up twice now, and I've really never heard of them before.
Oh, well, they're not very well known anymore, but they were a very radical group that got into politics in Amsterdam, and there was a guy named Kees Hoekert who had what was called the Lowlands Weed Company. Marijuana was legal in Amsterdam at that time, and neither Steve or I were big pot smokers, but it was an interesting story to look into and get to know these characters, and they were wild, wild characters. So, you know, but the police didn't like it, the fact that we had a car door that was barely hung on with wire, and so they took our car. We ended up getting another car and drove it to Paris and left it on the street, and in a couple of weeks it got stolen. So we didn't have much choice but to hitchhike, which turned into a grand adventure, but also a very scary one for both of us. I mean, Steve and I were very different kinds of people. Steve was very visual. I was an intellectual and very devoted to, you know, trying to figure out what was going on in the world. And so we were, I wouldn't say, well, we did often clash over our just, you know, daily life. I mean,
this happens when you travel anyway, but you put yourself in some pretty extreme circumstances.
Yeah, we did. And you know, we really had to get to know each other and ourselves in ways I think that we'd never been forced to do before. I mean, you know, Steve had a fiance back home and he was away from her, and that was really tough for him. And you know, we had to really struggle to learn how to live with somebody that was very different than we were. And we did it, you know. I mean, we became, we really, the word today is bonded. I mean, we became incredible friends. I think Steve is still my best friend from those early days. We don't see each other that often, but when we do, I mean, it's you know, we're just like brothers. But we went through a lot to get there.
I want to jump in here and play a little bit from this movie. The two of you waited 36 hours for your first ride as you started hitchhiking, and that seems to have been a sobering moment, or I guess sobering several moments. I want to hear a clip from where you guys are reliving that.
The heat would go from 100 during the day and as low as 40 at night.
And there's no water or anything there, so you have to have everything with you. I don't think we thought we were going to wait that long.
We put in our backpack cheese, dates, tins of sardines, water. You know, we had canteens with us, but pretty meager provisions.
Dick would type, and Dick would read books. I don't know exactly what I did. I don't think I had a book to read. So his mind was occupied. You know, I don't think he was afraid.
But Steve, you were afraid. Tell me about how you feel like you maybe experienced this a little differently.
Well, this is just the start of it. You know, this is just the start of the crossing. And I was worried about my fiancé, and my worry about my film went through the whole adventure because it was hot and there was sand, and I was afraid my film would be destroyed. So I'm sitting out there and I'm not occupied with anything, and a day and a half goes by. So at one point I go behind, there's a sign, and I go behind this sign and I start having a conversation with my oldest sister. I just get into a conversation, and then it helped. And then we went back. Dick had to go
back.
Your
sister who wasn't there.
No, she wasn't there. I just was talking to her. And it was my first sort of hallucination. But after 36 hours, we did get picked up, and we did get a ride with a Belgian couple who, you know, because people did pass us and didn't pick us up. And they offered us Godiva chocolates. So if you've been in the desert for 36 hours and you're kind of worried, and you meet this nice Belgian couple and they give you Godiva chocolates. It was a wonderful moment.
Yeah, I mean, there are many adventures between the point A we just heard about and the point B I'm about to bring up, but you ultimately did kind of have a breakdown in the desert with no money and no water and no hospital or mental health resources anywhere nearby.
I didn't have they called it acute anxiety. I didn't have it until we finally got to West Africa, and we checked into a motel, and I thought I was safe, and I woke up badly hallucinating, thinking I'd lost my mind, and I ran outside, and Dick came out and, you know, walked with me while I'm screaming and yelling that I've lost my mind. But in between, that's when all the tension started to build, you know, because it took us 6 weeks to make this trip, to get from point A to point B.
Dick, why don't you tell me about some of the aspects of the trip we haven't discussed that really were beyond the scope of what you ever would have imagined when you thought, hey, we're going to go across the desert. Woohoo.
Yeah, well, you know, this Belgian couple that picked us up didn't turn out to be such a nice guy. I mean, he was brilliant. He was 20 years old. He spoke 10 languages. He was a revolutionary. He was going off to fight for the revolution in Angola, he thought.
You had been looking for a revolutionary.
Yeah, you know, so this was at first, oh, this is perfect. Well, it turned out he had absolutely no practical sense. I mean, if we hadn't been with him, I think he never would have made it very far at all. You know, we'd get stuck in the sand constantly. He had a VW bus, and we went in caravan with these two British guys who had a very low-slung Ford Cortina. And, you know, and we were out there, and we'd get stuck, and then we'd put these heavy steel sand mats under the tires, and Steve and I would get back there and push. You know, it got to be very grueling. And then at one point, when we went into the neighboring country to Algiers, which is called Niger, both cars started breaking down continually, and it got really scary. I mean, we thought we'd get to the capital of Niger, Agadez, in a couple of days, and we were 5 days in, and we still hadn't made it, and didn't know if we were going to.
And water is an issue. You're in the desert.
Yeah, and we were just about out. We were carrying these jerry cans of water in the cars, but we were running really low, just about out, and Steve and I were out of food, and Tom didn't really seem to care, the guy driving the car, the revolutionary. He just pretty much, you know, would sit in the front seat eating an orange, and it was really not good. And we eventually... The Ford Cortina got stuck so bad, mired in the sand, we just couldn't get it out. And we hadn't seen another vehicle in a day and a half going either direction. And suddenly we saw, it was like a mirage on the horizon, this convoy of trucks approaching us, and they turned out to be the Niger military. And, you know, this guy stops and trains a machine gun on us, and we could have been blown away right there.
You know, there's a passage you read from the notes that you're taking all this time, because we've mentioned you're traveling also with a typewriter, which is hilarious on its own, but you're typing up your notes of what's happening, and you read a passage in the movie that just blew my mind. And I'm paraphrasing, but maybe you can help me out. It has to do with the revolution you were looking for and realizing that it had already happened, that everyone in the desert had kind of overthrown their own internal government.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this was kind of the end of my dreams about that a political revolution was going to change things. Just seeing the reality of this guy who was a complete dreamer. And actually tradition began to become much more important to me, which that was true in Ghana when Steve and I ended up spending a week in the court of the number two Ashanti chief, and saw him kind of caught between the traditions of the past that he was beholden to and the future, you know, where he was really sort of trapped in this way. A very a good man, but you know, it was my eyes were beginning to open up that there was something, just as they had before, there was something more than sports happening. I was realizing there was an internal battle going on, and also the need to connect in a relationship level. I mean, as I said before, Steve and I had to forge a relationship. And to me, relationships became, you know, the most important thing that life is all about.
Yeah, the idea I took away there is that that a revolution worth throwing has to bring out the goodness of human beings in, like,
exactly,
in actual behavior instead of an abstract ideal.
Right. I would say that sums it up.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll get right back to this conversation about the movie Hitchhiking to the Edge of Sanity, based on the true story we've been hearing, after this break. When we do, the filmmaker will join us. That's next. Stay tuned. Steve Ewart, Dick Russell, welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. I've been talking to these guys about a harrowing and transformative trip they took across the Sahara Desert in 1971. It's the basis for a documentary showing in the Kansas International Film Festival this Sunday evening. And now I want to bring the filmmaker in on our discussion, producer-director Scott Peterson. Hello.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
I'm good. I want to know how you came to the decision that you were going to make this story into a documentary. You have a personal connection to one of these characters.
Yes. So my last documentary I had shot in Mexico, and I live in Southern California, and it's a two-day drive to get to this location in Mexico where I shot. And so I thought, you know, the next documentary I want to do, I need to do something a little closer to home. And also in my native tongue, because my Spanish is only marginal, because the logistics of going to Mexico and the language, it made it a little difficult. And so Steve is my uncle. And, several years ago, you know, maybe 4 years ago, I was talking to him on the phone and he had just casually mentioned this trip.
I want to stop, because for people who don't remember, Steve is the one who, when I said, you know, did you also have an itch to be part of like this revolutionary early 70s thing? He's just like, no. So were you surprised? I mean, that this guy who doesn't seem to have that itch had this background, this backstory?
Well, the funny thing was is that so Steve's from Kansas. I grew up outside of Chicago, and Steve has a studio in Chicago. And so as a kid, my family would go down to Steve's studio for Thanksgiving or just whatever, just to visit. And I remember as a kid seeing some of the photographs from the trip, from the Ghana portion of the trip. And, you know, he had them mounted and they were just these crazy pictures. And I was just like, what are these? So, you know, I had remembered those, but then I just forgot about it. And then fast forward many years and, you know, talking to him on the phone, and he was just, and he mentioned, oh yeah, when I took that trip. And I was like, wait, tell me about this trip again. And he started telling me about it. And I was just like, that's crazy. Like all this stuff that happened. And I said, so does Dick ever make it to Los Angeles? And he's like, oh yeah, he lives there. And I was like, really? So Dick is very close to where I live. So it was logistically, it was much easier to go shoot this. So I was like, all these pieces of the puzzle are starting to fit together. So it's like I had this very interesting story. You know, Steve would talk to me because he's my uncle, and presumably he likes me enough to share his story. And Dick's close by here in Los Angeles. So all these things were great. And furthermore, it was very well documented. Steve had hundreds, if not thousands, of photographs. Dick, as was mentioned before, had a journal that he kept. And initially, when I was told there was a journal, I just thought it was like a handwritten, like spiral notebook or something.
Because that's what you would think someone would hitchhike across a desert
course.
With. Of not course. A typewriter.
Like, nobody would think like this metal typewriter, you know, has a handle on it, but it's like metal. And then the journal is, you know, single spaced, both sides of the paper, and it's like 3 inches thick. I mean, it's, you know, by the time he was done, it was this huge document. So I was like, I have all this great documentation. And then the articles that were written too. So there were published articles from their adventures. And so I was like, all right, this is pretty well documented. You know, this is something I can do, and it's a great story. So that's kind of the background.
What was it about the story that surfaced for you as really compelling or surprising? Because you did have already the knowledge that this adventure happened, but as you went deeper into it, what surprised you?
I mean, on a larger level, I just like adventure. You know, I think, you know, I like to travel a lot. And so it's, you know, for me, it's adventure is interesting and what happens. And I think travel makes you a better person because you understand different cultures and all that. But I didn't realize like how fraught with danger it was, you know, because now it's like, you know, if you would take that trip today, it would be certainly different just because the politics are certainly significantly different. But the communication is much easier now. Like you could have a satellite phone and talk to somebody in the middle of the desert, I would assume. But back in the day, you couldn't do that. And it's some of the things are interesting just from, you know, the logistical standpoint. You know, it's like you have to send a letter. You'd go to, I don't know, Dick, the American Express office or whatever, and you just send like letters like that. And it's just, you know, for 2017, it's hilarious. He's like, yeah, that's how you had to communicate if you were traveling, you know. So that's stuff I find sort of interesting. But certainly the danger is, you know, and how do you get out of these situations, and how do you survive these situations where you are out of your element in almost every single way, and you survive it, and you know you come out the other end, you know, a better person, and then you know you become friends for decades afterwards.
The friendship is part of what really interests me, because it seems like there's so much strain on this relationship for so much of the trip. But that also seems, when you step back from it, maybe a little bit inevitable. I mean, even just in how it starts, that you are these very different people with these very different relationships with, I don't know, what you're looking for. And then you put yourselves in this intense situation where really all you can count on is each other. And I wonder how you look back on that aspect of your friendship. Steve, I'll start with you.
Well, Dick gave me a chance to really have an adventure and use my new craft. And that was a phenomenal gift to me. And then he had all these ideas, so we would just follow them. But I was physical, and I could get things done. But I was also tightly wound, because I lived in an attic for 3 years studying engineering and photography. And Dick lived in a fraternity house, and he was, like, incredibly popular and successful. So you put these two guys together, but we got to use our craft together. And then
you being a photographer and him being a writer.
Yeah. And then you just don't know what's going to happen. And then in the end, I had what was like a breakdown, and I'm still emotional about how Dick helped me. And then we did our work, and we did phenomenal work in West Africa, some of our best work. We were, because of a picture I made that I wasn't supposed to make, we got thrown out of the chief's palace. We Dick did phenomenal dancing at a fetish priest's house. The pictures are all there. So in the end, we made it through, and we could still love each other. And more than we ever could imagine from the start, because we did this together. We fought and had conflict, but we came out on the other end completely like brothers.
What do you think that you learned from Dick on that trip?
Well, Dick was courageous. And I mean, there was a guy named Cartier-Bresson who was maybe one of the most famous photographers in the world. And I got a chance to go show this man my work because we had somebody that we met. And I was like hesitant to do it. And Dick said, let's go. And so you just learn from a guy like that. You just go, let's go. And I go, okay. But I wasn't alone. I was with him. So I learned about just taking risks and just doing it.
Dick, what did you learn from Steve?
You know, I think I learned about, because Steve has such a sensitivity, and which makes him a great photographer and a great portrait photographer today. But, you know, I had to find that more in myself. I mean, I was just, as Steve says, I was gung-ho. I just kind of forged ahead. And when he had his breakdown there when we first arrived in Accra, I'll never forget it. You know, waking up in the middle of the night and he's sitting up in bed and he in his bunk across from me, and he says, I've lost my mind. And I was shocked. I mean, you know, I'd never been through anything like this with anybody before. And I just suddenly had to open myself up and just do whatever I could, you know, to get my friend, my traveling companion, through this. And I'll never forget walking round and around this liberation circle, ironically they called it. And then suddenly a woman, and I realized I'd left my wallet in the room and I had no way to get to a hospital. And this woman came up to me out of nowhere and said, here, you know, take this. And she calls a taxi for us and gets us to a hospital. So I learned about compassion in that way, too. And then we got there and, you know, talked to a doctor, and Steve got through it. And but I think it's experiences like that in life that really, they just bring you closer together and with someone else who's going through it. And, you know, I've been through similar things since with other people, including my own son. But that was a real breakthrough. And I remember well, you know, after 8 months together, I mean, we were basically, you know, we were living together night and day for 8 months, these two very different people. And, you know, it was hard to say goodbye.
Scott, as Steve's nephew and also the filmmaker working with all this material, reading these articles, reading this journal, that describes moments in your uncle's life that are very vulnerable and very personal and show weakness. Did you learn anything? Like, not just artistically, the creation of a documentary, but did you learn anything from these guys?
Well, there were a couple of moments that were, like, unexpected. And typically in documentaries, when you're making a documentary, the best things are the ones that you never count on. Like, you never think, like, you know, I generally knew the story, of course, before doing these interviews. But then there's things that come up that you're just like, oh, you know, and, you know, thinking, oh, yeah, this is totally going in. And so when near the end, Dick and Steve get together and Dick brings out this letter that Steve had written to him, and he asks Steve to read it, and Steve kind of, you know, chokes up. And that was a really sort of enlightening and interesting moment.
Well, our time is up, as you can probably hear by the music coming up under us. But Scott Peterson, director of Hitchhiking to the Edge of Sanity, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Steve Ewart, thanks for opening up about your experiences in the desert.
Thanks.
And Dick Russell, this has been amazing. Thank you for joining us from California.
Thanks for having us, Gina.
Thanks, Gina.
You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard. And if you want to see the movie, it's showing at the Glenwood Arts Theater this Sunday at 5:20. Nice round time there, as part of the Kansas International Film Festival. The show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Suzanne Hogan, and Andrea Tudhope, although this is technically Andrea's last day on Central Standard. She's got a new job in the newsroom here at KCUR, and she's done a lot for this show, so I want to take this chance to say a big public thank you. I'm so glad she is only moving down the hall. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman, over and out.